Today's talk will be on Case 29 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 29 is entitled, The Sixth Ancestors, Your Mind Moves. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument. One said the flag moved, the other said the wind moved. They argued back and forth but could not reach a conclusion. The sixth ancestor said, it is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is your mind that moves. The two monks were awestruck. Mumon's comment, it is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is not the mind that moves. How do you see the ancestor? If you come to understand this matter deeply, you will see that the two monks got gold when buying iron. The ancestor could not withhold his compassion and courted disgrace. Mumon's verse, wind, flag, mind, moving, all equally to blame. Only knowing how to open his mouth, unaware of his fault in talking. So, if you haven't been here before for one of these talks, what I just read you, read out loud, probably sounded pretty strange. This is a little story about two monks who are in the courtyard of the temple, and they're arguing about a flag moving in the wind. In ancient times in China, Zen was quite important. You know, whenever I ask my students, I will sometimes say to my students, in our culture, in our society, what's the most important thing? And there's never any disagreement. They always say, money! And they're right. They understand quite clearly, in our culture, what's the most important thing? Money. And they say it without a moment of hesitation, and it's unanimous, and everybody looks pleased when they say it. You know, in ancient China, at one time in ancient China, the most important thing was enlightenment. And just as we have banks and finance system and stores, Walmart and ShopRite and so on, and McDonald's. In ancient times, people valued meditation very highly, and so probably most places, most towns had a temple, and all over China there were public temples where people could go and practice Zen, just like public schools here. And if you wanted to go to a temple and practice meditation, you had to take vows and enter the temple. And then you could go anywhere in China to any public temple. You had to have your ordination papers with you. And you presented them to a particular officer of the temple, and you would be admitted. And it was like, here's your bed. Here's your place in the meditation row. Dinner is at, 4:30. And we get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. So be up. So a lot of energy was expended on cultivating awakened mind. This was the money of 7th century China. When they would have sesshin, the temple would put a flag up outside at the edge of the temple, and the flag would fly. And believe it or not, everybody in the village would see that flag and they would think, oh, they're doing sesshin, we need to be quiet so they can wake up. So anyway, this is probably during sesshin, the monks shouldn't be talking, But they're in the courtyard and the flag is flying and they're having this argument. And one person is saying, the wind is moving the flag, but essentially it's the wind that's moving. And the other person says, no, no, it's the flag that's moving. Don't you see? It's moving right in front of you. So they're having this argument. And great Zen teacher known as the Sixth Ancestor, basically Wei Nang, is walking along, and he hears this conversation, and he says, it's not the wind, it's not the flag, it's your mind. And the koan, the little story, says they were dumbfounded. Now, you know, people might not understand how these talks work because they're used to a different approach. So, you know, some people, if they want to study Buddhism, they want to get a book that lists the principles of Buddhism. So, you know, basically, you might want to hear all, you know, about the Buddha's fundamental teachings. And you could, you know, if you own the book, you would underline the key teachings. You could study the teachings. You could commit them to memory. But, you know, that wouldn't necessarily change anything. It's not bad studying philosophy books or reading books on Zen. I think you should do it if it inspires you. But, you know, if you know all about the life of the Buddha, and you know all about the Buddha's teachings, and you can tell me about the Eightfold Path, and you can tell me about different aspects of Buddhist doctrine and so on, that doesn't necessarily mean you have experienced the world from moment to moment in a different way, you know? So, you know, I have friends who are in the philosophy department, some of them are nice people, and some of them are, so-so. Some of them are very interested in, I have a friend who's particularly interested in art. And he actually has written a lot on what are called aesthetics. You know, and I remember going into his office and just being impressed by what a slob he was. Now, if you come into my office, you'll realize I too am really quite a slob. But this man writes on aesthetics, and he talks about beautiful art. When you go into his office, it could be a warehouse. You know, I think he does like art. He spends a lot of time in museums. But I'm not sure that he has taken into his flesh and his bones the spirit of what he is studying, you know. So it's one thing to know something intellectually, and it's another thing to know something in your, as we say in Zen, in your flesh and in your bones. In other words, you know, you could attend a very interesting lecture on Buddhism, and when you got home, you could be in the same habits, with the same outlooks, as always. Nothing would have changed. See? So ideas do matter. Having the wrong ideas is really bad. So, you know, basically, if somebody tells you you need to be better than everybody else, you need to compete against everybody else and always win, and the losers deserve to lose and winners deserve to win, those are actually bad teachings. And if you hear that from somebody, you should realize that those are not lessons you should internalize. On the other hand, if you hear good lessons, you know, you should take them in. You know, if somebody says, be compassionate, you know, the highest virtue is compassion, connect with others, demonstrate active care, you know, and so on, then you should take those in. But even if you take those in, it only sort of soaks in a little bit, you know. This is why we do Zazen, why we do meditation. You know, we can study ideas, and we can study principles, and we can try to commit them to memory, and we can try to even practice them in our lives, but it only goes so far. And with something like meditation, we're not just changing what we think. We're changing how we experience from moment to moment. See, this is my friend, the aesthetic philosopher, the aesthetic theorist, has a messy office. You know, maybe it just hasn't changed the way he thinks experiences from moment to moment. You know, I will never forget being in college, and my friend Larry Sullivan, who's still my friend after all these years, we were taking a philosophy course together. And we were reading a philosopher on nonviolence and what used to be called reverence for life. There was a philosopher named Albert Schweitzer who taught a kind of philosophy called reverence for life. And we were both talking and debating about Dr. Schweitzer's wonderful ideas. And as we were talking, I can't remember if it was a fly, I think it was a fly or a mosquito, or I think it was like some kind of a bug, flew by, and my friend just immediately swatted it, you know. And then, you know, he swatted it, and then we both sort of looked at each other like, oh my God, that wasn't reverence for life, you know. But it was too late, you know. And we both laughed at the time. You know, we made a mistake. But the thing is, you know, our ideas didn't translate into behavior. Our ideas didn't translate into perception. We had an intellectual appreciation for reverence for life. But, almost automatically, almost instinctively, when my friend saw this fly, he swatted it. Because that's what he's been doing 100 times. So there's this gap between what we believe and how we experience. You know? So, you know, it's one thing to read in a philosophy book, all is one. All is one. You know, that's a wonderful idea. You know, ultimately, everything is one. But, you know, when we go through our daily lives, we don't experience everything as one. We experience everything as two. You know? Typically, we are not connected to the world around us as fully as we might be. You know, this is just a fact. You know, when I teach people who are beginners here about meditation, I sometimes ask them, are you a college student? And they'll say yes. And then I'll say, what's your least favorite course? And I'm always hoping they won't say expository writing. Because I run the expository. And so far, you know what? Nobody has said expository writing. Maybe it's because they know I run the expository. But if people think for a minute, the calculus, you know, chemistry, I'm always relieved, right? They might say chemistry or something. And I myself did not enjoy chemistry. I thought it was kind of dry. I didn't really see the potential. So for me, it was just memorizing C's and H's and things like that. And little connectors and so on. When I give this example, you know, they always say, I chemistry is my least favorite class. And I say, when you're in chemistry, you know, you're often, your body is in chemistry, but your mind is in Hawaii, right? And they smile, because this is such a familiar human experience. We're here, but we're not here. You know, various things happen to us in life that encourage us not to be present 100%. It's just a fact. You know, and often we're in relationships or situations that are very difficult and sometimes unpleasant. So, in my office, we have a friend of mine is having a conflict with somebody else who works in my department. And my friend came to see me yesterday and said, oh, I have just had another argument with so-and-so. This is, institutional politics. And the person she had an argument with is really a terrible, in my opinion, a very, very bad person in a lot of ways. And is really, if he argues with you, he goes for your throat. You know, he's really relentless. He says many hurtful things. So my friend is a very intelligent person, but she was hurt. Her feelings were hurt because this guy really just kicked, he hits below the belt, as we say. And she came in to see me. She was looking for reassurance, you know. And I mean, I could see the pain on her face, the suffering. And, you know, and I imagined she wanted to be somewhere else. You know, she wanted to be somewhere else, not here, in some other world where this wasn't happening. So, you know, we develop a habit, right? We develop this habit where we're here but not here. We're here 10% or 20%, but most of us is not present, you know. And this is like becomes a life habit. In Zen, we call this a divided mind. See, from the Zen standpoint, a divided mind is the fun. You know, in Christianity, there's a teaching of original fall, the Adam and Eve. Adam offered Eve, Eve offered Adam an apple, and Adam ate the apple, and they both fell, and so on and so on. This is also true in Jewish tradition, right? But there's this concept of original sin. Well, there isn't really an original sin in Buddhism, but there's this idea that it's like we have a tendency as humans to be here but not to be here. You know, we're here 10% and we're somewhere else 90% of the time. You know, and we all do this. We all do this. But we develop a habit of being separate from the world. Separate from the world. And reading books doesn't necessarily solve that problem. You know, it's good ideas are something you should internalize. And beware, you know, be critical and think through ideas and don't internalize bad ideas. But even good ideas don't necessarily encourage you to be 100% present, you know, so that we carry around all day a sense of separateness from things, you know. And in some ways, we are constantly encouraged to try to get past our separateness in ways that don't really pay off, you know, that don't really pay off. When I was in high school, you know, my father was in the military, in the Navy, and we used to move from place to place. I remember when I was growing up, I had lived in Baltimore, Philadelphia, another part of Maryland, Silver Springs. The Naval Weapons Station in Southern Virginia, the Naval Weapons Station in San Diego, the Naval Weapons Station in Bremerton, the Naval Weapons Station in Bangor. You know. So, you know, my brother and I would get to a school in the middle of the school year. So we'd come in the middle of the year, and we'd try to adjust, you know, and it was hard to adjust. And basically, we would finally get adjusted. Kids would start accepting us. You know, we'd begin to make friendships. And then, like 2 years later, we'd have to leave again. And it would be the beginning of the year, and we were in Bangor, Maine, or we were in Bangor, Washington, and then we'd have to go to San Diego and start all over. So after a while, you know, I began to live very much sort of to myself, right? It was like, why make friends? Because I'm only going to have them for a little while. So I became a bit of a loner. And when I was in high school, you know, I felt isolated. And, you know, I used to study really hard and get good grades. And I think in a way, one of the reasons I wanted to get good grades was so people would like me, you know. But actually, people didn't like me more for getting good grades. You know, maybe they might have liked me more if I didn't get good grades. But I was trying to overcome my sense of isolation or distance in a way that didn't really solve the problem. I should have tried to make friends more, you know. And another way our culture does this is to encourage us to buy things that we don't really need, you know. So, you know, I think that we're always looking for connection. We're always looking for connection. And our culture is constantly selling us on, like, artificial connection. So basically, you might go to the store and see a shirt, and you think, I don't really need a shirt, but maybe if I get that shirt, somehow my life will be different. And you buy the shirt, and you wear it to work, and you know, after about 10 minutes of being at work, you forget what color your shirt is, right? You know, so you might be driving to work thinking, oh, I love my new shirt. You know, 10 minutes into your job, you could be wearing a t-shirt, it doesn't matter. So we sell items, things, commodities, you know, saying this will make you more connected. But it doesn't really work a lot of the time. Every once in a while, I guess it works. But I see all these kids with their, iPads and so on, and they're constantly searching. I do it too. I get on my computer. And, you know, I'll surf the net, and I'm looking for something. You know, I'm looking for, I'm looking for connection, right? But it doesn't really come. You know, I'll read this online journal. I'll read the New York Times online. I'll do this. I'll surf. Sometimes, you know, late at night, I'm working at home, and I'll be writing something, and I just can't stand it anymore. So I'll think of somebody I knew in high school, and I'll Google them. I don't know if you ever do this. But sometimes, you know, I'll find somebody and think, oh, what do you know? You know? Sometimes it's interesting, right? I don't have the nerve to send them an email. Say, how's it going? Do you remember me? I was the geek at the back of the class, you know, who was always trying to get good grades so people would like him. But, you know, it doesn't really solve the problem of being separate from things, right? You know, you can Google people online, but it doesn't solve it. And even writing an email doesn't really solve the problem, I think. You know, maybe I'm just old-fashioned, but I like to go to lunch with people, so I'll send somebody an email and say, let's go to lunch. And, you know, I like to go to lunch, and I get out of my office. I've been in the same office for 25 years. So it's important for me sometimes to get out of my office, you know. And I'll get out of the office and I'll go to lunch with somebody. And, you know, seeing their face is nice. You know, they sit down, you have a conversation, you eat together. This is really lovely, you know. I think this is a way of making contact. At least I feel like I'm making contact with somebody. It's not the same thing as sending somebody an email. And, you know, when I first started doing my job, we didn't have, believe it or not, there was no email. There weren't even computers. When I started doing my job, there was a typewriter in my office. And I would come in the morning and I would open my mail, which was actually printed on paper. And I would open the mail, and then I would start calling people on the phone, you know. And I would call people all morning. And I loved talking to people on the phone. You know, I'd say, you know, one of the deans at Douglas College was named Marge. How's it going, Marge? You know, go, great. You know, what did you do this weekend? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, by the way, you know. And then we'd get to the business at hand, you know. And I loved that. And, you know, all day long I would be on the phone with people. And I felt like I was making more contact than I do with email. Email is very bodiless, you know. So I think we're hungry all the time for contact. And I think we have all these electronic devices that promise us to be connected, but I don't think we really feel connected. I really don't. And there's a very high rates of depression in our society, and many, many people report being lonely, you know. And I think it's because we have these electronic ways of connecting instead of ways of connecting face-to-face. I really do. I think it would be better, instead of going on Facebook, to meet somebody for lunch or go shoot some basketballs with them, shoot some baskets with them. So I think our culture sells us on connection. It promises us connection, but it doesn't really deliver. You know, so it's like, if you get this, your life will be better. If you buy this product, you know, you buy the product, and within a little while, it's like, it's just a meaningless object, right? I think this is quite common. Even like, you know, cars. People sell cars, and they're so important, you know. And you pay a lot of money for a car, and you want the car to sort of say who you are, right? So, you know, if you want to be a daring person, you might get a sports car, you know. And, you know, you get the sports car and you drive it around, and for a little while you might feel like, oh, everybody is seeing that I'm this kind of person. But, you know, after a while it's just a car, you know, and it doesn't really solve the problem of isolation. And so I think we have this, part of it is a fundamental human problem of feeling isolated. Or feeling separate. And I think our culture exploits these fears or these anxieties in a million different ways, you know, usually to sell us things. But I don't think they solve the problem. And I think that if you study a book on Buddhism, it doesn't solve the problem either, although it's better than reading something that wouldn't be so good, you know, so edifying. But, you know, meditation practice is really about this fundamental problem of feeling separate from other things, feeling separate. And, you know, we do meditation on Saturday, so and if you get here early, you can do 5 periods of meditation. You know, if you come here at 7 o'clock, we recite sutras, and then at 8 o'clock we do half an hour, and then another half an hour, and then another half an hour, and then we have a little break to go to the bathroom. And then there's another half an hour, and another half an hour. And during this period, if you just do one of, you know, you do an hour, that's great. If you do 5 sessions, you know, that's even better, because you go through a process when you meditate. You know, you start out the meditation practice feeling maybe 10% present and 90% absent, or 15% present and 85% absent, you know, something like that. And if you have had conflicts or problems in your life, the sense of absence may be very, under the surface, it may be very powerful. So, you know, my friend yesterday who had this big fight with another person in my department, you know, she was really hurting. You know, and when people are hurting, they withdraw from the world very, very much, very, very much. You know, if somebody's really hurt your feelings and you go into your room, you know, you might not even know if it's raining or sunny, you know. You're just so withdrawn into yourself. You know, or if you're in some kind of a crisis, you know, you might not even know what time of day it is. You know, if something's going wrong at work, you know, you can be so caught up in fear and agitation that everything around you just disappears and you're sort of left alone with your fear and agitation. So, you know, when people start doing Zazen, that's where they sort of start out. You know, you might start out just tired, or you might start out full of dread or agitation, or maybe you've been through some unpleasant experience, but you're very withdrawn, very withdrawn. And you know, we can be so withdrawn that we don't even experience our own bodies. You know, we almost have no body. We're sort of floating. You can be so withdrawn you're even floating a little bit above the earth. You know, a friend of mine from many years ago worked in the writing program, and she had an appendicitis attack, and she didn't even know it. So her appendix ruptured, and she continued to work. And she finally went to the hospital and said, I've got a fever of 105. I wonder what's wrong. And the doctor said, they checked her and said, my God, your appendix has ruptured. Aren't you feeling any pain? You know, years later, I was talking to her about this. And, you know, it turns out that when she was growing up, she was physically abused. I guess her mother used to just really beat her up physically. So, you know, my guess is that she developed a habit of being very, very distanced from the world around her. You know, in fact, even from her own body. It's not normal it's not normal to have an appendicitis attack and not notice. You know, because nobody has an ruptured appendix and has no pain. But some people are so detached from their own bodies that they don't even experience their own pain. You know, they find a place to put that pain behind a little door and they close the door. This is quite common, believe it or not. You know, we can be very far removed from the world. We can be very far withdrawn from our own bodies. We can withdraw in other ways too. So, you know, we start sitting on the cushion in this state of very much being outside of our life, somewhere else, right? And people make a habit out of this. You know, when we recite, you know, Atta Dipa Viharata Atta Sarana, one way to translate that is we're saying the Dharma is my refuge, you know. It's where I go to solve my problems. You know, some people go into this disembodied no place to solve their problems. They go to this place that's outside of the world, and that becomes their habit. That's their default mode of dealing with life, is withdrawal. And like my friend who didn't even notice when she had appendicitis. So we can be even so withdrawn from our own bodies that we don't notice something like that, but we can be very withdrawn from other people, you know. Meditation is about working through that isolation. And when we sit down on the cushion and we watch our breath, we're gradually bringing ourselves into connection with the world. You know, we're gradually, you know, we're so withdrawn sometimes. When we sit down on the cushion, we're trapped in our heads, we're trapped in our ideas. You know, you might come in to sit and you might not know if it's winter or summer sometime. You know, you can be so distracted. And, you know, working with the breath, we watch the breath, we watch the next breath, we watch the next breath. And this is like grounding yourself in the present moment. Grounding yourself in the present moment. So, you know, basically you're very withdrawn, but you keep coming back to the breath. And it pulls you into the present. And it pulls you into the present. And you might have a big struggle with this. Because people make a habit of being somewhere else, not here. And, you know, you can be lost in your thoughts, lost in your emotions. You watch the breath, you watch one breath, two breaths, and then you're gone. But you keep coming back little by little, you know, you begin to stay in the moment. And this is usually a big struggle for beginners, or it can be the struggle at the beginning of a big struggle at the beginning of a sit. Because you're returning to earth, basically. You're returning to the present. And, you know, after one sit, maybe, you're a little bit more present. And then, you know, we do another sit, and you're a little bit more present. And if you do, say, five sits in a row, you know, there's ups and downs. You have your distractions come back, and it could be a struggle. And maybe you have discomfort in your legs and so on. But, you know, actually just being aware of the discomfort in your legs is a kind of awareness of moment also. So, you know, you keep coming back to the moment, and as we sit, you know, as we go through this process, we, even though it might not feel this way, you're becoming more and more unified with the world around you. It may not feel that way. You know, people sometimes misunderstand the kind of consciousness you should be entering when you're in deep concentration. You know, so you might be a mathematician or something, and when you're working with numbers, you might feel very crisp and present. You know, so if you're a chemist or you're a scientist, you know, when you're doing your work, you might feel very crisp and very present. And so some people expect meditation to be like that, right? Or you should be crisp and present, you know. But actually, it won't feel like that. You know, when you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, you're not going to feel crisp and present. You might even feel a little bit you might feel strange, right? Like you're not asleep and you're not awake. It's not the kind of consciousness we associate with being crisp and present. But that's actually a very shallow kind of consciousness. When you feel crisp and present, when you feel very self-consciously alert, that's actually not a particularly unified state of being in the moment, believe it or not. You know, as you watch your breath, you're going to enter a state of consciousness which might feel almost a little dreamlike. It might feel a little bit like you're not asleep and you're not awake. But this is actually a deeper, from the Zen standpoint, this is actually a deeper form of consciousness. It's like descending through the layers of your mind and reaching a place that is much more fundamental than the thinking part of the mind. The part of the mind that says, you know, the square root of 312 is such and such, that's actually a rather shallow part of the mind. You have a much deeper part of this, your awareness has a much deeper level, which is much more, much less conceptual. It's much more connected to fundamental perception, fundamental perception. It's not on the level of ideas, it's on the level of these very, very simple perceptions. And so when you're meditating, as your mind becomes deeper, you may enter a state that seems rather dreamlike, but you're not falling asleep. This is like a more elemental kind of consciousness, more fundamental kind of consciousness. When you enter this state of consciousness, this is a good thing, not a bad thing. It's not distraction. It actually shows that you're getting more grounded in the moment, more grounded, more present. And so, you know, people who do a lot of meditation all have had this experience of being strikingly unified with something in their surroundings. So, you know, you can be in this rather, what feels like a rather primitive state of awareness, you know, where you're watching the breath and your mind feels odd. It's like you've dived into a pool and you're down in the deep water. And it might feel unfamiliar, and it might not feel very present or sharp. But actually, it's a kind of elemental awareness, pre-conceptual awareness. On that level, you're connecting, or you're preparing to connect. You know, and then you know, at the end of an evening of meditation, you do three sits, and you have tea, and the tea might seem so incredibly delicious. So many people come. In fact, just the other night, somebody said, "We did meditation last night, and we had two beginners. And at the end of the whole evening, one of the beginners said, 'That was the best tea I ever had in my life. What is that tea?'" And of course, it's Zen tea, because they had done meditation for an hour. And their mind was very clear and open. And when they tasted the tea, there were no obstructions. So, you know, for a moment there, 100% present with the taste of tea. This is a highly desirable state, 100% present. This is a familiar experience to people who do Zen, right? You know, sooner or later, people have experiences where they get off the cushion and leave the zendo and go out and look at a tree, and they just feel like they're one with the tree. Or you drink the tea and your whole being is tea. You know, years ago I can remember coming out of a sesshin, and we were driving home, and Glenn Webb, my second teacher, stopped at a Quick Check or something to get something, and I turned on the radio of the car, and there was just this like pop music on, like bubblegum music, you know. my baby's gone or something, you know, something like that. And I just listened to that and it just broke my heart. It's like, oh, loss, you know, the experience of loss, so deep, you know. And the music was trivial, but my heart was so open, my perceptions were so open that it was, you know, it was like exquisite. So, you know, Zen is all about overcoming this sense of isolation. And it, you can't overcome it just by reading or acquiring ideas. And you can't overcome it by getting a new device from the Apple Corporation. That's really profoundly dishonest, you know, actually. You know, you can't be connected with a device that doesn't connect you. It's just another way of being, in my opinion. Yeah. Okay, I myself have a phone, I work online, I send emails, but it's not connection, you know. This is all about connecting, about returning to our fundamental oneness with things by undoing our mental habits of separation and going down to this level of like elemental perception, and then encountering something like the taste of tea or the sound of the wind, and becoming, feeling totally one with it. You know, I had been doing Zazen for a number of years, and I remember one night we were sitting in the Zendo and thunder was crashing around the Zendo, and Genki Roshi said something like, you know, someday that thunder will feel like it's coming out of your own body. And at the time I thought that would be really cool, that would be really something. You know. But I didn't understand what he meant. You know, I was reading in the newspaper yesterday, it was a headline in the newspaper, it said 400, New York Times, big letters, 400. That's the parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. You know, and people read this and they just go back to their regular lives, right? I read it, I jumped in my car, you know, and put some more CO2 into the atmosphere. Part of the problem is we have a system, right? How do you get out of the system? We've created this CO2 producing system, and just to get to work you have to do it, you know. But I also think that we have this habit of being detached from the world, and we live in a very dead world, you know, generally speaking. You know, our world is full of things we experience in a very separate or detached way. And so, you know, the world seems very remote from us. I think it's one of the reasons people can deal with something like this without, you know, they can encounter this information without responding. So I think so often we're in a rather detached or lifeless situation. And, you know, this, you know, it seems it's happening somewhere, but, you know, okay, the world is in trouble, but, you know, I don't usually live in the world. I live in the world and somewhere else, right? So I think we have a habit of being very detached. You know, I remember reading recently an interview with some people who lived in Siberia. And they lived in this valley in Siberia, and they were talking about how they saw the natural world as part of their own bodies, you know. And these people live like in very primitive conditions. They don't have television. They don't have a radio. They don't practice Buddhism. They practice something called shamanism. They have basically a religion earlier than Buddhism, earlier than Christianity, shamanism. And they said, you know, we think of the earth as our own body. And I think that's very healthy. I think that's really healthy. We're very far from having that kind of experience. But we know in a certain way, intellectually, that everything is connected. We know that. You know, you study that in a biology class. You study that in an ecology class. But experientially, things are not connected. We live in a very disembodied, disconnected way. And so, you know, Buddhism, you could say, is all about connecting. And you know, the joy that comes from practice, you might not understand why you feel so happy. You know, on a Saturday, sometimes I come here and I'm really tired or something's gone wrong in the week, and I sit down on the cushion and, you know, five sits later, I feel so great. You know, you work through your stuff and you get to a point where you just feel wonderful sometimes. And, you know, we got up today and we did the Kinhin, and I felt like just every step of my body was wonderful. You know, really, I just felt good. You know, yesterday I walked to the student union from my office, and I was full of anxiety about problems, and I have deadlines. And, you know, walking was, you know, I don't even remember walking. I know I walked. But, you know, just taking these mindful steps down the hall and back, it was just like bliss, really, just beautiful, beautiful. Every step is beautiful because I was more present. You know, so Zen is all about this. You know, if anybody ever says Buddhism is about detachment, please correct them. Just say, no, Buddhism is not about detachment. You know, it's about connection, connection. So in this little story, you know, there are two monks, and they're supposed to be doing zazen, but instead they're behaving in a way that's very separate from the world around them. They're arguing with each other, they're having a little fight, and also they're looking at this flag, and they're talking about it intellectually. You know, it's okay to talk about things intellectually, but there's a deeper way to experience the world. They're not experiencing the world in that deep way. So, you know, they're having this debate. The wind moves, the flag moves. And Wei Nang is walking by, Eino. And he says, you know, it's not the wind, it's not the flag, your mind, your mind. Now, what he means is, experience all of this as one thing. He means sit down on the cushion and dissolve the boundary between yourself and the world. Sit down on the cushion and be 100% here, present now, which they're not. And he's telling them, be present 100%. Dissolve that distance. Become the wind. Become the flag. See this, and when we do this, everything comes alive. I mean, it's just a fact. You know, I think our culture produces, it makes some of our habits worse. You know, those people who lived in that valley in Siberia, I think they very often experience the world as their body. I think they do. I don't think it's a conceptual statement. I think they really experience the world as self. But in our culture, we don't experience things as self. In fact, that's actually discouraged. I hope you won't think I'm being too socially critical right now, but why not? About 20 years ago, my father and in-law invited, and my mother-in-law invited my wife and I to go to British Virgin Islands. And my father-in-law rented a boat, and we went around the British Virgin Islands, and they're breathtakingly beautiful. I myself don't like to be on a boat. I don't enjoy it. I like to walk. So we would get to shore on one of these islands, and I would just jump off and walk for or I liked to walk, so I would go on these long walks. And my wife and I went on a walk, and we were looking out over the ocean. We were up on this hillside, and there was this little house, you know, this little house made of cement, and it was painted pink. So this breathtaking view, you were 200 or 300 feet above the ocean, all these trees all over the hills and some fields, this little pink house, and we were standing there. These guys drove up in a jeep. They were, you know, Americans, and they all had beers in their hand. They said, man, if we could put a motel right here, right? I just thought, no, don't do it. That's a different relationship to the world than just being present with it, I would say. You know, they wanted to get something out of what they were experiencing. This is like an opportunity for basically to make $1 million or something. But my feeling is that there's another way to interact with the world. You know, and when we stumble into it naturally sometimes, it's really glorious. You know, you just walk out into the forest and you see trees, or you see birds taking flight, and you feel lifted out of your deadness, and you feel connected. And Zazen is like this too, right? You know, you sit down on the cushion, you work through your deadness and your distance, and you get off the cushion, and this feeling of well-being is really a feeling of connectedness. So, you have two monks arguing, and they are basically not in connected mind. And Wei Neng says, you are fundamentally everything you experience. Be with that. And they're dumbfounded, it says. And that's actually good, right? Their discriminating mind is silenced, and they have suddenly maybe an intimation of this connectedness that's so fundamental. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument. One said the flag moved, the other said the wind moved. They argued back and forth but could not reach a conclusion. The sixth patriarch said, it is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is your mind that moves. The two monks were awestruck. Mumon's comment, it's not about the wind, it's not about the flag, it's not about your mind, it's how you see the world. If you come to understand this matter deeply, you will see that the two monks got gold when buying iron. The ancestor could not withhold his compassion and courted disgrace. In other words, he actually pointed directly to reality. Mumon's verse, wind, flag, mind moving, all equally to blame. In other words, wind, flag, mind, all one life. Only knowing how to open his mouth, unaware of his fault in talking. So the ancestor opened his mouth and spoke without any hesitation or self-doubt. And you can act and speak from this place of connectedness too.